A bucket of water splashed into Rincewind's face, jerking him out of a dreadful dream in which 100 masked women were attempting to trim his hair with broadswords and cutting it very fine indeed. Some people having a nightmare like that would dismiss it as castration anxiety, but Rincewind's subconscious knew being cut to tiny bits mortal dread when he saw it. It saw it most of the time. He sat up. "Are you all right?" said Kanina, anxiously. Rincewind swiveled his eyes around the cluttered deck. "Not necessarily," he said, cautiously. There didn't seem to be any black-clad slavers around, at least vertically. There were a good many crew members, all of them maintaining a respectful distance from Kanina. Only the captain stood reasonably close, an inane grin on his face. "They left," said Kanina. "Took what they could and left."
"They bastards," said the captain. "But they paddled pretty fast."
Kanina winced as he gave her a ringing slap on the back.
"She fight real good for a lady," he added. "Yes."
Rincewind got unsteadily to his feet. The boat was scudding along cheerfully towards a distant smear on the horizon that had to be Hubward Clatch. He was totally unharmed. He began to cheer up a bit. The captain gave them both a hearty nod and hurried off to shout orders connected with sails and ropes and things. Kanina sat down on the luggage, which didn't seem to object.
"He said he's so grateful he'll take us all the way to Al-Khali," she said.
"I thought that's what we arranged anyway," said Rincewind. "I saw you give him money and everything."
"Yes, but he was planning to overpower us and sell me as a slave when he got there."
"What, not sell me?" said Rincewind, and then snorted. "Of course, it's the wizard's robes. He wouldn't dare."
"Actually, he said he'd have to give you away," said Kanina, picking intently at an imaginary splinter on the luggage's lid.
"Give me away?"
"Yes, sort of like one free wizard with every concubine sold,
"I don't see what vegetables have got to do with it."
Kanina gave him a long, hard stare, and when he didn't break into a smile, she sighed and said, "Why are you wizards always nervous around women?" Rincewind bridled at this slur.
"I like that," he said. "I'll have you know that... Well, look, anyway, the point is, I get along very well with women in general. It's just women with swords that upset me." He considered this for a while and added, "Everyone with swords upsets me, if it comes to that."
Kanina picked industriously at the splinter. The luggage gave a contented creak.
"I know something else that'll upset you," she muttered.
"The hat's gone."
"What?"
"I couldn't help it. They just grabbed whatever they could."
"The slavers have made off with the hat?"
"Don't you take that tone with me. I wasn't having a quiet sleep at the time."
Rincewind waved his hands frantically.
No. Don't get excited. I wasn't taking any tone. I want to think about this."
"The captain says they'll probably go back to Al-Khali," he heard Kanina say. "There's a place where the criminal element hang out, and we can soon..."
"I don't see why we have to do anything," said Rincewind. "The hat wanted to keep out of the way of the university, and I shouldn't think those slavers ever drop in there for a quick sherry."
"You'll let them run off with it?" said Kanina, in genuine astonishment.
"Well, someone's got to do it. The way I see it, why me?"
"But you said it's the symbol of wizardry, what wizards all aspire to. You can't just let it go like that."
"You watch me," Rincewind sat back. He felt oddly surprised. He was making a decision. It was his. It belonged to him. No one was forcing him to make it. Sometimes it seemed that his entire life consisted of getting into trouble because of what other people wanted. But this time, he'd made a decision, and that was that. He'd get off the boat at Al-Khali and find some way of going home. Someone else could save the world, and he wished them luck. He'd made a decision.
His brow furrowed. Why didn't he feel happy about it?
"Because it's the wrong bloody decision, you idiot."
"Right," he thought. "I've had enough voices in my head. Out."
"But I belong here."
"You mean you're me?"
"Your conscience."
"Oh."
"You can't let the hat be destroyed. It's the symbol of..."
"All right, I know. The symbol of magic under the law. Magic under the control of mankind. You don't want to go back to those dark eons."
"What?"
"Eons.
Do I mean eons?"
"Right, eons. Go back eons to the time when raw magic ruled. The whole framework of reality trembled daily. It was pretty terrible, I can tell me."
"How do I know?"
"Racial memory."
Gosh, have I got one of those?
Well, a part of me.
Yes, all right, but why me?
In your soul you know you are a true wizard. The word wizard is engraved on your heart.
Yes, but the trouble is I keep meeting people who might try to find out, said Rincewind miserably.
What did you say? Said Kanina.
Rincewind stared at the smudge on the horizon and sighed.
Just talking to myself, he said.
Carding surveyed the hat critically. He walked around the table and stared at it from a new angle. At last he said,
It's pretty good. Where did you get the octarines?
They're just very good ankh-stones, said Spelter. They fooled you, did they?
It was a magnificent hat. In fact, Spelter had to admit, it looked a lot better than the real thing. The old Arch-Chancellor's hat had looked rather battered, its gold thread tarnished and unravelling. The replica was a considerable improvement. It had style.
I especially like the lace, said Carding. It took ages.
Why didn't you try magic?
Carding waggled his fingers and grasped the tall, cool glass that appeared in mid-air. Under its paper umbrella and fruit salad, it contained some sticky and expensive alcohol.
Didn't work, said Spelter. Just couldn't seem to get it right. I had to sew every sequin on by hand.
He picked up the hat box.
Carding coughed into his drink. Don't put it away just yet, he said, and took it out of the bursar's hands. I've always wanted to try this.
He turned to the big mirror on the bursar's wall and reverently lowered the hat onto his rather grubby locks. It was the ending of the first day of the sorcery, and wizards had managed to change everything except themselves. They'd all tried, on the quiet, and when they thought no one else was looking. Even Spelter had a go in the privacy of his study. He had managed to become 20 years younger, with a torso you could crack rocks on, but as soon as he stopped concentrating, he sagged, very unpleasantly, back into his old familiar shape and age. There was something elastic about the way you were. The harder you threw it, the faster it came back. The worse it was when it hit, too. Spiked iron balls, broadswords, and large heavy sticks with nails in were generally considered pretty fearsome weapons, but they were nothing at all compared to 20 years suddenly applied with considerable force to the back of the head. This was because sorcery didn't seem to work on things that were intrinsically magical. Nevertheless, the wizard had made a few important improvements. Carding's robe, for example, had become a silk and lace confection of overpoweringly expensive tastelessness, and gave him the appearance of a big red jelly draped with antimacassars.
"It suits me, don't you think?"
said Carding. He adjusted the hat brim, giving it an inappropriately rakish air. Spelter said nothing. He was looking out of the window. There had been a few improvements, all right. It had been a busy day. The old stone walls had vanished. There were some rather nice railings now. Beyond them, the city fairly sparkled, a poem in white marble and red tiles. The River Ankh was no longer the silt-laden sewer he'd grown up knowing, but a glittering, glass-clear ribbon in which, a nice touch, fat carp mouthed and swam in water pure as snowmelt. Of course, Ankh-Morpork's citizens had always claimed that the river water was incredibly pure in any case. Any water that had passed through so many kidneys, they reasoned, had to be very pure indeed. From the air, Ankh-Morpork must have been blinding. It gleamed. The detritus of millennia had been swept away. It made Spelter strangely uneasy. He felt out of place, as though he was wearing new clothes that itched. Of course, he was wearing new clothes, and they did itch, but that wasn't the problem. The new world was all very nice. It was exactly how it should be, and yet... Had he wanted change, he thought, or had he only wanted things rearranged more suitably?
I said, don't you think it was made for me? Said Carding.
Spelter turned back, his face blank.
The hat, man.
Very suitable.
With a sigh, Carding removed the Baroque headpiece and carefully replaced it in its box.
We'd better take it to him, he said. He's starting to ask about it.
I'm still bothered about where the real hat is, said Spelter.
It's in here, said Carding firmly, tapping the lid.
I mean the real one.
This is the real one.
I meant this is the Arch-Chancellor's hat,
said Carding carefully.
You should know you made it.
Yes, but,
began the bursar wretchedly,
after all, you wouldn't make a forgery, would you?
No, not as such.
It's just a hat. It's whatever people think it is. People see the Arch-Chancellor wearing, they think it's the original hat. In a certain sense, it is. Things are defined by what they do. And people, of course. Fundamental basis of wizardry is that. Carding paused dramatically and plonked the hatbox into Spelter's arms. Cogitum ergot hatto, you might say. Spelter had made a special study of old languages and did his best.
I think, therefore, I am a hat, he hazarded.
What? Said Carding, as they set off down the stairs to the new incarnation of the Great Hall.
I considered I'm a mad hat, Spelter suggested.
Just shut up, all right.
The haze still hung over the city, its curtains of silver and gold turned to blood by the light of the setting sun, which streamed in through the windows of the hall. Coyne was sitting on a stool with his staff across his knees. It occurred to Spelter that he had never seen the boy without it, which was odd. Most wizards kept their staves under the bed, or hooked up over the fireplace. He didn't like this staff. It was black, but not because that was its colour, more because it seemed to be a movable hole into some other more unpleasant set of dimensions. It didn't have eyes, but nevertheless it seemed to stare at Spelter as if it knew his innermost thoughts, which at the moment was more than he did. His skin prickled as the two wizards crossed the floor and felt the blast of raw magic flowing outwards from the seated figure. Several dozen of the most senior wizards were clustered around the stool, staring in awe at the floor. Spelter craned to see and saw the world. It floated in a puddle of black night, somehow set into the floor itself. And Spelter knew with a terrible certainty that it was the world, not some image or simple projection. There were cloud patterns and everything. There were the frosty wastes of the Hublands, the counterweight continent, the Circle Sea, the Rimfall, all tiny and pastel-coloured, but nevertheless real. Someone was speaking to him. He said, and the sudden drop in metaphorical temperature jerked him back into reality. He realized with horror that Coyne had just directed a remark at him.
I'm sorry, he corrected himself. It was just that the world is so beautiful.
Our Spelter is an aesthete, said Coyne,
and there was a brief chuckle from one or two wizards who knew what the word meant.
But as to the world, it could be improved. I had said, Spelter, that everywhere we look we can see cruelty and inhumanity and greed, which tell us that the world is indeed governed badly, does it not?
Spelter was aware of two dozen pairs of eyes turning to him. He said.
Well, you can't change human nature.
There was a dead silence. Spelter hesitated.
Can you? He said.
That remains to be seen, said Carding. But if we change the world, then human nature also will change. Is that not so, brothers?
We have the city, said one of the wizards. I myself have created a castle.
We rule the city, but who rules the world? Said Carding. There must be 1,000 petty kings and emperors and chieftains down there.
Not one of whom can read without moving his lips, said a wizard.
The patrician could read, said Spelter.
Not if you cut off his index finger, said Carding. What happened to the lizard, anyway? Never mind. The point is, the world should surely be run by men of wisdom and philosophy. It must be guided. We've spent centuries fighting amongst ourselves, but together, who knows what we could do?
Today the city, tomorrow the world, said someone at the back of the crowd.
Carding nodded.
Tomorrow the world, and, he calculated quickly, on Friday, the universe.
That leaves the weekend free, thought Spelter. He recalled the box in his arms and held it out towards Coyne, but Carding floated in front of him, seized the box in one fluid movement, and offered it to the boy with a flourish.
The Arch-Chancellor's hat, he said. Rightfully yours, we think.
Coyne took it. For the first time, Spelter saw uncertainty cross his face.
"Isn't there some sort of formal ceremony?" he said.
Carding coughed.
"No," he said. "No, I don't think so."
He glanced up at the other senior mages, who shook their heads.
"No, we've never had one, apart from the feast, of course. You see, it's not like a coronation. The Arch-Chancellor, you see, he leads the fraternity of wizards. He's...
Carding's voice ran down slowly in the light of the golden gaze. He's the first among equals. He stepped back hurriedly as the staff moved eerily until it pointed towards him. Once again, Coyne seemed to be listening to an inner voice. "No," he said eventually, and when he spoke next, his voice had that wide, echoing quality that if you're not a wizard, you can only achieve with a lot of very expensive audio equipment. "There will be a ceremony. There must be a ceremony. People must understand that wizards are ruling. But it will not be here. I will select a place. And all the wizards who have passed through these gates will attend. Is that understood?"
"Some of them live far off," said Carding carefully. "It will take them some time to travel. So when were you thinking of?"
"They are wizards," shouted Coyne. "They can be here in the twinkling of an eye. I have given them the power. Besides..."
His voice dropped back to something like normal pitch.
"The university is finished. It was never the true home of magic, only its prison. I will build us a new place."
He lifted the new hat out of its box and smiled at it. Spelter and Carding held their breath.
"But..."
They looked around. Hark Hardly the Law Master had spoken, and now stood with his mouth opening and shutting. Coyne turned to him, one eyebrow raised.
"You surely don't mean to close the university," said the old wizard, his voice trembling. "It is no longer necessary," said Coyne. "It's a place of dust and old books. It is behind us. Is that not so, brothers?"
There was a chorus of uncertain mumbling. The wizards found it hard to imagine life without the old stones of UU. Although, come to think of it, there was a lot of dust, of course, and the books were pretty old.
"After all, brothers, who among you has been into your dark library these past few days? The magic is inside you now, not imprisoned between covers. Is that not a joyous thing? Is there not one among you who has done more magic, real magic, in the past 24 hours than he has done in the whole of his life before? Is there one among you who does not in his heart of hearts truly agree with me?"
Spelter shuddered. In his heart of hearts, an inner Spelter had woken and was struggling to make himself heard. It was a Spelter who suddenly longed for those quiet days, only hours ago, when magic was gentle and shuffled around the place in old slippers, and always had time for a sherry, and wasn't like a hot sword in the brain, and above all, didn't kill people. Terror seized him as he felt his vocal cords twang to attention and prepare, despite all his efforts, to disagree. The staff was trying to find him. He could feel it searching for him. It would vanish him, just like poor old Bilias. He clamped his jaws together, but it wouldn't work. He felt his chest heave. His jaw creaked. Carding, shifting uneasily, stood on his foot. Spelter yelped.
"Sorry," said Carding.
"Is something the matter, Spelter?"
said Coyne.
Spelter hopped on one leg, suddenly released, his body flooding with relief as his toes flooded with agony, more grateful than anyone in the entire history of the world that 17 stones of wizardry had chosen his instep to come down heavily on. His scream seemed to have broken the spell. Coyne sighed and stood up.
"It has been a good day," he said.
It was 2 o'clock in the morning. River mists coiled like snakes through the streets of Ankh-Morpork, but they coiled alone. Wizards did not hold with other people staying up after midnight, and so no one did. They slept the troubled sleep of the enchanted instead. In the Plaza of Broken Moons, once the boutique of mysterious pleasures, from whose flare-lit and curtain-hung stalls the late-night reveller could obtain anything from a plate of jellied eels to the venereal disease of his choice, the mists coiled and dripped into chilly emptiness. The stalls had gone, replaced by gleaming marble and a statue depicting the spirit of something or other, surrounded by illuminated fountains. Their dull splashing was the only sound that broke the cholesterol of silence that had the heart of the city in its grip. Silence reigned, too, in the dark bulk of Unseen University. Except... Spelter crept along the shadowy corridors like a two-legged spider, darting, or at least limping quickly, from pillar to archway, until he reached the forbidding doors of the library. He peered nervously at the darkness around him, and after some hesitation tapped very, very lightly. Silence poured from the heavy woodwork. But unlike the silence that had the rest of the city under its thrall, this was a watchful, alert silence,
It was the silence of a sleeping cat that had just opened one eye. When he could no longer bear it, Spelter dropped to his hands and knees and tried to peer under the doors. Finally, he put his mouth as close as he could to the draughty, dusty gap under the bottomest hinge and whispered,
"I say, can you hear me?"
He felt sure that something moved far back in the darkness. He tried again, his mood swinging between terror and hope with every erratic thump of his heart.
"I say, it's me, Spelter, you know? Could you speak to me, please?"
Perhaps large leathery feet were creeping gently across the floor in there, or maybe it was only the creaking of Spelter's nerves. He tried to swallow away the dryness in his throat and had another go.
"Look, all right, but look, they're talking about shutting the library."
The silence grew louder. The sleeping cat had cocked an ear.
"What is happening is all wrong,"
the bursar confided, and clapped his hand over his mouth at the enormity of what he'd said.
"Ooh?"
It was the faintest of noises, like the eruption of cockroaches. Suddenly emboldened, Spelter pressed his lips closer to the crack.
"Have you got the, patrician in there?"
"Ook."
"What about the little doggy?"
"Ook."
"Oh, good."
Spelter lay full length in the comfort of the night and drummed his fingers on the chilly floor.
"You wouldn't care to, let me in too?"
he ventured.
"Ook."
Spelter made a face in the gloom.
"Well, would you, let me come in for a few minutes? We need to discuss something urgently, man to man."
"Ook."
"I mean, ape."
"Ook."
"Look, won't you come out then?"
"Ook."
Spelter sighed. "This show of loyalty is all very well, but you'll starve in there."
"Ook. Ook."
"What other way in?"
"Ook."
"Oh, have it your own way." Spelter sighed, but somehow he felt better for the conversation. Everyone else in the university seemed to be living in a dream, whereas the librarian wanted nothing more in the whole world than soft fruit, a regular supply of index cards, and the opportunity every month or so to hop over the wall of the patrician's private menagerie. No one had ever had the courage to ask him what he did there. It was strangely reassuring.
"So you're all right for bananas and so forth?" he inquired after another pause.
"Ook."
"Don't let anyone in, will you? I think that's frightfully important."
"Ook."
"Good."
Spelter stood up and dusted off his knees. Then he put his mouth to the keyhole and added,
"Don't trust anyone."
"Ook."
It was not completely dark in the library, because the serried rows of magical books gave off a faint octarine glow, caused by thaumaturgical leakage into the strong occult field. It was just bright enough to illuminate the pile of shelves wedged against the door. The former patrician had been carefully decanted into a jar on the librarian's desk. The librarian himself sat under it, wrapped in his blanket and holding waffles on his lap. Occasionally, he would eat a banana. Spelter, meanwhile, limped back along the echoing passages of the university, heading for the security of his bedroom. It was because his ears were nervously straining the tiniest sounds out of the air that he heard, right on the cusp of audibility, the sobbing. It wasn't a normal noise up here. In the carpeted corridors of the senior wizard's quarters, there were a number of sounds you might hear late at night, such as snoring, the gentle clinking of glasses, tuneless singing, and once in a while the zip and sizzle of a spell gone wrong. But the sound of someone quietly crying was such a novelty that Spelter found himself edging down the passage that led to the Arch-Chancellor's suite. The door was ajar. Telling himself that he really shouldn't, tensing himself for a hurried dash, Spelter peered inside. Rincewind stared.
"What is it?" he whispered.
"I think it's a temple of some sort," said Kanina. Rincewind stood and gazed upwards, the crowds of Al-Khali bouncing off and around him in a kind of human Brownian motion. A temple, he thought. Well, it was big, and it was impressive, and the architect had used every trick in the book to make it look even bigger and even more impressive than it was, and to impress upon everyone looking at it that they, on the other hand, were very small and ordinary and didn't have as many domes. It was the kind of place that looked exactly as you were always going to remember it. But Rincewind felt he knew holy architecture when he saw it, and the frescoes on the big and, of course, impressive walls above him didn't look at all religious. For one thing, the participants were enjoying themselves. Almost certainly they were enjoying themselves. Yes, they must be. It would be pretty astonishing if they weren't.
"They're not dancing, are they?" he said, in a desperate attempt not to believe the evidence of his own eyes. "Or maybe it's some sort of acrobatics."
Kanina squinted upwards in the hard white sunlight.
"I shouldn't think so," she said thoughtfully.
Rincewind remembered himself. "I don't think a young woman like you should be looking at this sort of thing," he said sternly. Kanina gave him a smile.
"I think wizards are expressly forbidden to," she said sweetly.
"It's supposed to turn you blind." Rincewind turned his face upwards again, prepared to risk maybe one eye. This sort of thing is only to be expected, he told himself. They don't know any better. Foreign countries are, well, foreign countries. They do things differently there. Although some things, he decided, were done in very much the same way, only with rather more inventiveness, and by the look of it, far more often.